and roll. I got Brian Briscoe back on the Capital Racer Show, season three, now powered by Pitch Decks. How are you, brother?
Hey, doing great, Ruben. Doing great.
Welcome back, man.
Thanks for having me again. I thought after that first one, you know, you'd never bring me on again, but I guess, yeah, guess it worked out.
Life comes in seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Man, the first time that I had you on, I was still with Bakerson, which seems
I was still with Four Oaks. So, you know, it seems like ages ago too. So
we're both fund managers. How about that? So referencing Capital Racer Show 84, released September almost 2 years ago. Well, actually, by the time this comes out, it will be over 2 years ago. Fascinating. Cool, brother. Well, this is going to be fun, man. We're going to spend some time talking about what you've been up to. But before we go down that direction, why don't you tell us how you got into real estate to begin with?
I got into real estate. It's going to sound cliche because it's the same thing for everybody. I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, and I started really thinking about assets. And until then, I had drunk the Kool-Aid and I was thinking, okay, you know, your personal residence is going to be the bulk of your financial, your net worth and whatnot. And he obviously debunked that. I started really thinking about assets and how to start acquiring assets. And I was active duty in the military at the time. And I decided to use something that I had a competitive advantage in, and that's being able to use a personal, not the personal loan, but owner-occupant loan, which gives you a much better rates and terms when you're buying investment properties. So we moved 10 times in 20 years. So on average, it was moving every 2 years or so. We'd move to a new place, look right and say, hey, does it make sense to buy an investment property here or not? And that's really how I started. Was, okay, we moved here, we bought an investment property, we moved there, we bought an investment property, and over my active duty time, I didn't buy a ton, ended up with 3 properties, but it was enough for me to get to understand the business, the appreciation, the cash flow, and realize that I wanted more.
Cool. And then how did you transition into multifamily?
Yeah. So transitioning to multifamily, I started getting to the end of my Marine Corps career, and it's the retirement system for military is fairly archaic, I think. A lot of people, I hope, would agree, but it's like a light switch. Once you get to your 20-year mark, light goes on and all of a sudden you get a retirement benefit. And 19 years, 11 months, no retirement benefit. So I started getting close to the point to where I could retire and get a pension. And I started looking at exit plans. I was fascinated by real estate. It was something that I loved talking about. I loved learning about. And I was always looking to buy another property. So I started spreadsheeting. I'm thinking, okay, here's how much money I make right now. How long would it take me, or how many properties would I have to have, single family properties would I have to be able to hit that number? And the answer was way too many. And I started thinking, holy cow, I think 60 was the number. And I remember thinking, holy cow, how long is it going to take me to buy 60 properties and get them all set up and off? And it was a little depressing to go through that exercise, but I think end of the day, I started looking at other things. How can I accelerate that? And the answer was buy 5 at a time or buy 10 at a time. And that's multifamily, you know, buy 20 at a time. And that's what really got me into the multifamily thing, was just realizing the ability to scale, the ability to start racking up units. And I look at a 20-plex as buy one, get 19 free. It's kind of how I look at that. So that's what got me into multifamily, was just trying to fix the scale problem. I don't want to have to go out and buy 60 single family properties to get my number.
Cool. I think a great deal of my audience is very familiar with you because they probably go to your TGIF meeting and perhaps they're even part of Tribe of Titans and they listen to your podcast as well. And I want to talk about some of these things, particularly like as you're transitioning into funds. But before we go down that road, I'm very curious about your military experience. You're a Marine, correct?
Yep. Marine, okay. Retired almost a year ago today.
Good experience. But yeah. Before you retired, you came on the show and you're like, oh, I see the light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. I'm curious though, because sometimes I talk to people that have been in the military and they don't they don't have fond memories of their time in the military because they went places where things were involved and people died and things like that. Was your experience good or bad, or how would you describe it?
It was good enough that I stayed 20 years. I'm fortunate. I've been to several combat zones, but I haven't been in actual combat. I've never had to point a rifle or a pistol or any weapon at another person and pull a trigger. So as far as that goes, my job in the Marine Corps is I was always supporting the people that were doing that. And that's kind of the focus. And that's one thing I think the Marine Corps does well is they focus everything on that Marine who's out front pulling a trigger and making sure that Marine has all the support that he or she needs. And end of the day, my role was largely sitting in the command headquarters and making sure their trigger pullers had everything they needed. So as far as my experience, my deployments were boring. It was almost like Groundhog Day where you wake up and you do the exact same thing every single day for 200 days straight. And then you go home and you get 10 days off and it's back to work again. Overall, it was positive enough. I think, you know, that the Marine Corps handed me just the right incentives at the right time to keep me in. So, you know, at my 4-year mark, I wanted to get out. It was my first opportunity. And I remember saying, if I get this one very specific job, I'll stay in. And lo and behold, they gave me what I asked for, you know? And so that's kind of like the whole story of it. It's like, okay, if I get this, I'll continue to serve. And the Marine Corps, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, kept on giving me, you know, exactly what I wanted. And it turned into a 20-year career.
Thank you for your service, man. That's pretty awesome. I am curious about this because when you came on the show, from my recollection, you were going through this phase that I think a lot of people have to go through, not specifically because they're coming from the military, but because they need to brand themselves as a multifamily investor instead of whatever it was in their past life. And they struggle doing that. So talk to us about the transition for you. How did you become known as a multifamily guy when everybody knew you as the military guy?
Oh, that was hard. That really, really was. And the first deal that we got under contract was just over three and a half years ago. We closed on it about this time 3 years ago. So looking at that process, when I started talking to people about, hey, do you want to invest with me? Or, hey, I've got this property under contract. We're looking for investors. The most common response that I got was, I thought you were a Marine, or I didn't know you were into this, or can you do that while you're active duty? You know, so I think the issue that I had is most people looked at me and thought Brian the Marine. And if you looked at my social media profiles at the time, that was probably the first word on every single one of them. So for me, it was just a deliberate campaign to start changing people's minds. And I went on a podcast tear. And this time 2 years ago, I was probably recording 8 podcasts a week. 3 of them my own, but 8 podcasts a week to try to get the word out, to try to start having people see me as the investor. I took the word Marine and Marine Corps off of all of my social media. So if you were to look at my LinkedIn around this time 2 years ago, you wouldn't have seen the word Marine anywhere on there. It wasn't because I was not proud of it. I still am, and I since put it back up there. But I wanted people, when they met me, to think, oh, that's Brian the apartment investor. And so the first thing I really had to do was change my own mind about it. And then after I changed my own mind about it, I think it was a lot easier to change everybody else's mind about it. But it was just a matter of social media, posting a lot about multifamily and real estate in general on social media. And I was in several different real estate specific groups and multifamily specific groups where just very deliberately posting in those, answering questions. And part of it, I think, really changed my own mind on it. You know, just the fact that I was doing this every day. Slowly, I started seeing myself as Brian, the real estate investor, Brian, the apartment investor. And after that, it was pretty easy for me to convince other people that that's who I was.
So I speak fondly and have great memories of my time with Bakerson. However, at some point, I needed to get bigger and grow my wings and expand beyond my previous company. Can you talk to us a little bit about that phase of life for you as a syndicator, being in Four Oaks? What did you learn about syndicating, and why did you go off into your next role in life?
I would say I learned almost everything I know about syndicating through Four Oaks. And when I say through Four Oaks, I mean, it's because that's where the bulk of my experience was. I was in a coaching program, and so I learned a lot of the basics from the coaching program, but I'm the type that learns by doing. It's one thing to read about it or to listen to somebody talk about it on a webinar or whatnot, but I would attribute the baseline that I have to all of my activities with Four Oaks. And the first three properties, I was on the acquisition side. After that, I started focusing more on due diligence than asset management. And then when COVID came in and military, I was literally on lockdown. I mean, not literally, but I could not leave the local area. I could not travel to the Carolinas and Georgia where our properties were. So I had to take an alternate role. So with Four Oaks, I was part of directly acquiring three properties, managing assets for several months, probably about a half year of me being the one asset manager. And then after that, I transitioned to capital raising. So it gave me a breadth outside of capital raising. I'm the mile wide, inch deep guy. And then Four Oaks funded the podcast. And I think everything else that I've learned has largely come from the podcast and all the other activities that are associated. So that's what it did for me. But at the end of the day, we were not 100% aligned. We had different ideas of what a good deal was. We had different ideas of what direction to go. We had different ideas on how to get places. And the longer we were together, the more that showed. And it's not that anything bad happened. It's just that when you're consistently not agreeing with, hey, I want to buy this type of property in this metro and not, I think we ought to look in this metro and get out of this type of property type stuff. I guess best way to put it is I was consistently agreeing to things that I didn't agree with. I would say, I really don't want to go this direction. I don't think this is right, or I don't think this is right for me or right for us. But I consistently was agreeing to things that I didn't agree with for sake of the team. And eventually that got to the point to where I realized that this is going to keep happening. This is going to keep happening if I stay in this partnership. And I got to my breaking point and I just said, all right, guys, I'm done. So that was really, really what it came down to. And like I said, it's not that they were doing anything wrong. It's just that I wanted to go a different direction. I wanted to do things differently and they didn't.
I think a lot of people knew who Brian Briscoe was a lot more than they knew who Four Oaks Capital was. I think the same could be said about the Capital Raiser Show. A lot more people are familiar with that brand than they are with my previous company or even my existing company. They're like, Capital Raiser Show, yeah, rock and roll Capital Raiser Nation, but they don't know where I do business, which is kind of, it's fun. But what was that like being the face of your company? Talk to me about, because you sound like you did a bunch of other things besides be the head of marketing or the head of exposure, better said, for your company. Talk to us about that particular aspect, because that's hard. It's hard to be the face, to represent yourself in a good light and constantly be on display, if you will, for the world to see. What was that like for you?
It's something that I kind of grew into. It's not a role that I wanted up front. I don't think I ever wanted to be the face. We had originally decided that one of my partners would be more of the face. But once again, that was one of the things that I agreed to the partnership. I'm like, okay, I can do this. I can post on LinkedIn. I can do the podcast. Originally, the podcast, one of my other partners was supposed to be hosts. Really, end of the day is you always have to be turned on, if that makes sense. And not turned on like flip the switch and the batteries are operating and whatnot. But that part is, it can get tiring. If I have to record, you know, four podcasts a week to keep the podcast going, I've always got to be on. I do a lot of what I do on LinkedIn. I'm going to all these conferences and it can get tiring, but at the same time, there's a lot of benefits to being the face. And I'll tell you, there was a period where it was extremely difficult. And that was right before I made the formal announcement that I was leaving Four Oaks. I would say there was probably a month where I was just feeling a lot of angst and anxiety before I made the decision. And there was another month before I started telling people, right? So there's a 2-month period where that part was extremely difficult because I am part of Four Oaks, or I was part of Four Oaks, but I knew that I was leaving. or I knew that I wasn't happy with Four Oaks. And so that part was difficult. And if you go back into my LinkedIn archives and look at some of the things I posted, I did once and it was kind of fun. There's a much different tone to what I was posting. And it was a lot edgier and a little more raw, but amazingly, it got a lot of traction. So yeah, being the public face ended up doing me a lot of good when I decided to transition, because I think you hit the nail on the head. You said something that a lot of other people have told me. It's just like, when I started telling people I was leaving Four Oaks, I would get the response like, I didn't even know you had partners, or I have never even met any of your partners, or like, hey, weren't you partnering with that guy with like hair, beard, always wore
I've never met any of your partners either, or your old.
Yeah. So that's the response I kept on getting. And the more and more that I heard that, the more encouraging it got. I was probably, if I would have went and visited a shrink around February this year, he probably would have said, yeah, you're depressed. Here's some meds. But as I started talking to more and more people and telling people what I had planned, I got so much encouragement from people that had invested with me. I called every single one of the investors that I brought into Four Oaks Deals and told them personally. And I got such an overwhelming positive response that it was just like, all right, I got this. Step two, here we go.
You totally got this. I got to ask about this because I don't think I've shared this too much on the show or even with you. Maybe I did that time at the Vertical Street Ventures. Shout out to Ronnie Grew and those guys. One of the things that I did as I was leaving my company is we were in the middle of a capital raise and I had already raised like $425,000 of CoGP capital. And I walked away in the middle of the capital raise before the deal was closed because I didn't want to have any ongoing duties in a deal with that company into the future. And I gave up my GP slice of that. Now, a lot of people are familiar with, but may not be thinking of this particular aspect. When you leave a company, if you are in deals with them, you can't just stop your ongoing duties in those deals in order to stay legally compliant. You have to stay on board and do your ongoing duties into the duration of that entire deal. So how has that been working on those deals while you are transitioning to something else?
Fortunately, I am not the asset manager. Okay. And that's made it a lot easier for me, but I am still a GP member. And what we did is my GP shares in the property were through the company. And so when I left the company, we basically converted company shares into GP shares into the property. So now on all the properties that Four Oaks owns and operates, I'm roughly a 20 to 25% GP shareholder. So I still have responsibilities on the property and I'm still getting the weekly reports from the property managers. I'm still opening the reports up, reviewing them. And when we're talking about properties, you know, things are pretty cordial. And we're talking about, when we're talking about existing assets and whatnot, that's something we were always on board with. Let's manage this right. Let's do everything right. The friction points were usually, where are we going from here? Which direction are we going? What are we looking for next? But the actual management of the properties hasn't changed. And I'm still in a supporting role.
Okay, cool. So let's talk about CoGP structures. I want you to gear this towards the person that is looking to CoGP into future deals. They may not know all the intricacies of negotiation, how it's set up, how to bring CoGPs, what that looks like, feels like, how to operate with them throughout a project. So I know that there was a few deals where you had a few different GPs. Hutch, the marine investor, comes Hutch to mind one. On one, at least one. So talk to me about what you learned about creating CoGP structures and gear it towards the person that's trying to learn about how do I do that?
So one thing that I think I've learned over and over again is it's a reputation thing. And so when I'm looking at CoGPs, I want people who can deliver. And that's really the bottom line is I want people who can deliver. And so as somebody who wants to come in as a CoGP, I think my personal opinion, you want to get into CoGP roles, but once you're in, you need to perform. And we've done two deals where we brought in CoGPs and the people who delivered are the people that I'll pick up the phone and I'll call again. All right. The people who struggled, now I'm if I need a capital raiser for something, and through the Tribe of Titans right now, I have a lot of people who are looking at deals, and raising capital seems to be the thing that a lot of people lack the most. But when I'm looking at, okay, who can potentially come in and raise capital for these people? Who do I know that could raise $500,000 or $1 million? I'll look back at people who've raised with us before and say, okay, they hit their mark, they hit their mark, they hit their mark. Let me see if they're interested. These guys didn't come close. These guys got 50%. I probably won't call them again. So I would say for the beginning capital raiser, make sure you hit your mark. Whatever it is you commit to, make sure you hit that mark. And that's probably the most important thing from my experience.
With my old team, when I was with them, I was getting mentored and still am being mentored by the Good Egg Investment Ladies and the Real Estate Accelerator Program. They really talked about automations and branding and marketing and website presence and standing out in this sea of syndicators. How do you do that? And I brought a lot of their kind of tutelage to my old team. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, but I could never get them to implement it. We never updated the website. We didn't do a lot of the automations or the communications. And it was frustrating knowing that we were supposed to do certain things that my very successful mentors told me to do, but I couldn't get the team to do that. Is there anything that you learned about working with Four Oaks that you want to make sure you absolutely do something different in your future endeavors?
I think your experience was very similar to mine. We paid for a course where people showed us the automations, and they actually gave us the automations on ActiveCampaign. And all we had to do was sign up with ActiveCampaign and set them up. And the partner who was supposed to do it never did. There was one partner who I don't think ever went all in. Even after three and a half years in the business, I still find myself on the phone with him explaining basic concepts. And so one thing that was difficult for me is getting the investor list, downloading the investor list from our database and thinking there's no tags in here. There's nothing in here that says pre-existing relationship or whose relationship. It was absolute mess. I've spent the greater part of the last couple of months trying to set it up as I set up the automations as I think they should be set up. And from not having done that with Four Oaks, we could have raised so much more money. We could have done so much more. And, you know, that was part of the reason, that was definitely part of the reason that I wanted to leave, is because we weren't implementing a lot of the things that could help us get to the next level. And I really felt that Four Oaks was going to continue to play at the JV level when we all wanted to go varsity, but I didn't think that we as a group were putting in what needed to be done to play at the varsity level.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. All right, let's jump into funds a little bit. So now you are a fund manager. What have you learned about bringing in co-GPs into your fund or fund structures? Or what have you learned about why do people do a fund instead of just one-off syndications?
I think funds can, and my fund is called Streamline, and there's a reason for that. I think funds can streamline your capital raising. I think it streamlines it from the capital raiser perspective. It streamlines it from the deal sponsor perspective. And it can also streamline it from the investor perspective as well. If you invest from the investor perspective, how about this? From the sponsor perspective, if I'm bringing in money through a fund, there's one entity. Okay. One entity. It doesn't matter how many investors are in the fund. There is one single entity that sponsor has to worry about. And so when they're producing K-1s, there's one K-1 that goes out to the fund. There's a lot of streamline when it comes in. You know, now I'm not having to give the investors, or as a capital raiser, I'm not giving the sponsors a spreadsheet with 30 names on it and then social security numbers or EINs or entities, or this guy's an SDIRA, this guy's using personal funds, this guy's investing through an LLC, he's got a trust, she's got a yada, yada, yada. So it very much streamlines the process for the deal sponsor. It's one entity, one EIN, one K-1, and I do all the communication. So they don't even have to worry about communicating with the investors there. So from the GP perspective, I think that's a really good thing about funds, and it's going to be a larger dollar amount than any single investor puts in. From a capital raising perspective, depends on how you do it. as a fund manager, there's more than two ways I can get paid. There's two ways that I can mainly get paid. Number one is negotiating percentage of the GP. Number two is just walking in and says, hey, my fund's going to put a seven-figure sum into your deal. I want to hire pref. And so you negotiate better returns. And as a fund manager, you make your money off the delta. You know, so you make sure that your investors are getting more money for investing through the fund. But if you do it that way and you plug your fund in and you don't get a GP percentage, you have no responsibilities to that GP. In a way, you've kind of sidestepped the broker dealer laws. So it's just a way where you plug the fund in as an LP and you come in as a fund manager. Now, I would caveat with saying every time you're raising capital, you know, have your attorney on speed dial, because it's very nuanced. And you ask six attorneys, you're going to get eight different answers. But from a capital raiser perspective, it's also streamlined, because I think that the repeat investor, it's a lot easier to get people to repeat invest. One thing, Four Oaks sold its first property in April. I think we hit like 30% IRR on that property, which is an extremely good deal, but we gave everybody their money back. So from a capital raiser perspective, you know, ideally people reinvest with you. And I think with the fund structure, people are a lot more likely to reinvest with you, because their money by default is going to stay in the fund. The fund is the investment vehicle, not the property. And so by default, the money stays in the fund. And then when you have your next deal, you pick up the phone and you call up, hey, Joe, you've got $78,000 sitting in the fund. I've got two opportunities you can invest in. Which one do you want? So from a capital raiser's perspective, you're going to get a lot more repeat investors. And then from the investor's perspective, you can invest with several different sponsors through a fund, have one portal, and it simplifies a lot of things that you do. One portal, one K-1. So if you're invested in my fund and you're invested in 12 different deals, one single portal, one single K-1 every year, it's a lot easier. So anyway, I think there's dozens of reasons, but I took a very short answer and I think went 12 minutes with that one.
No, it's all good. And I'm about to go a little crazy here, trying to complete conceptual analysis on a variety of things that you said. Mm-hmm. Brian Burr came on the show. I know he's been on your show as well. And he likes to talk. When I asked him about why would you do a fund instead of a one-off syndication, he said that with one-off syndications, you have a wide varying degree of investor experience. So some people might get a 40% return on one deal, and then you might have like a thorny deal that kind of doesn't really make too much money and might have a 15%. And when you put all of these syndications into one funding vehicle, just like when you go into mm-hmm. real estate from the stock market, it smooths out that volatility mm-hmm. of all of the varying deals. And he also spoke, I think you might have even been referencing some of the stuff that he said, probably on your show, about the whole K-1 thing. And especially if you have a lot of investors, instead of writing multiple K-1s on multiple deals all the time for individual syndications, having everything in a funding vehicle is incredibly beneficial from that regard. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about is you mentioned that you can get paid a couple of different ways. You can participate in acquisition fees. You can negotiate all kinds of things, including an apple pie at Christmas, if that's what you want. That's the kind of stuff that Melanie McDaniel likes to talk about, mm-hmm. how you can negotiate crazy things if you want.
Yeah.
Specific communication. But a lot of times what people don't realize, and I want to hit on this because we talk about it rarely on the show, but within fund managers, this is something that gets brought up quite a bit. When somebody comes and asks me to raise capital for them, a lot of times they don't realize that if I'm going to write a $1 million check, if I want better terms, they have to have a side letter agreement in place before I can complete that. And if I'm going to create a fund structure, it takes some time to do this. So I have to have a relationship with somebody for many months before I do business with them. And I can't typically, unless it's through a co-GP structure, but in any regards, I probably would never raise capital for anybody if the deal is already in progress, and especially not if it's going to close in the next 2 weeks. So yeah, one agreed. Of the things you have to have is that side letter agreement in place. And some people set up their syndications with the understanding that there's going to be a certain class of investors that if they bring $1 million, they're going to get paid much better than the $50,000 investor. And you mm-hmm. don't have to worry about that whatsoever. I did want to talk about this real quick. is the different funding structures. And I'm going to ask you real quickly what you decided with, because what I've seen is a lot of talk about different ways to do this. SPVs, if you're going to start that as a fund, you should probably invest into more than one deal. And sometimes people will start an SPV specifically to raise for one particular sponsor or for one particular deal, which is even worse than one particular sponsor. But that doesn't represent the entire reason why people tend to start funds, which is for the purpose of diversification amongst multiple sponsors, multiple markets, multiple deals, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So SPV, probably make sure that your lawyer agrees to that. There's this other thing called the blind pool fund, which I hear is the hardest type of capital raise on the planet, because people have to trust you completely and blindly before they invest into your deal. And hopefully you set up your fund in such a way where it's just going to do one thing. The business model says, I'm just going to do in five different markets, this exact, very similar style of multifamily syndication. And there's not going to be like investing in Bitcoin and ATM funds and mm-hmm. self-storage and this and that, because that requires a great deal of trust. And a lot of times the beginning fund manager doesn't have that yet. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of hybrid thing that is not a one-off syndication or an SPV or a blind pool fund, but it's this thing called a series LLC, I've heard it called. Mm-hmm. I've heard other people call it a pledge fund. I've heard other people call it a deal-by-deal segregated fund, where people can create one master LLC, and then every time they syndicate a deal, they start a new fund for that. Actually, that's not true, because you can have multiple deals in the fund, but it's all owned by one particular LLC. And then that fund can ask its investors, or give the opportunity to its investors, better said, to choose what deals they want to participate in and which ones they don't. It's very expensive to do this. Some people, once again, it's sometimes called a deal by deal segregated fund, and people don't give that money to you until they see the deal. It's not sitting in an account and you're paying interest on it, but they just give you like a pledge saying, hey, if you find this deal that your business model has identified as something you want to do, then I'm committing that I probably will invest with you, and you can hold them to that, or just say, hey, like, who's in and who's not. You have different levels of requirements that you do this. But what kind of a fund structure did you end up doing on your...
I did what you refer to as a segregated fund. And the company that I went through, full service company, they run the portal, and they have a couple of two syndication attorney groups that you can choose from to do your paperwork, and a couple of banks. So it's basically a full service, but it is a customizable fund. And when I say customizable, just like you said, you know, the investors are not putting money into the fund in blind faith that I'm going to invest it well. I show them a deal. I say, do you want to invest in this deal? And the accounting is the hard part. Is now when money comes in, money comes out, we just got to be a little more careful with the accounting. And that's actually one of the things I use Avestor in there. Awesome. That's one of the things that their software does for me as a fund manager, is all of the accounting. When people come into the fund, it's like, hey, I've got this deal in Atlanta, or I've got this deal in Houston, or I've got this deal in Orlando. And do you want to invest in this specific deal? And you basically put walls around that money, and that money gets parked very specifically into those deals. And basically, from the investor standpoint, they have complete control over where their money goes. If I am raising capital for a specific deal that doesn't meet somebody's investment criteria, they can easily say no. One other thing, and I didn't realize the value of this until just recently, but if somebody invests in a customizable fund, the fund minimum, I still have a set fund minimum, but once you're in, you're in. And if you want to invest lower amounts than the stated minimum, that's really, really easy for me to do. It's really easy for me to, hey, my stated minimum is 50,000, but you've already got 50 in the fund. You want to invest in this next deal? How much do you have? Yeah, I'll take 10, sure, because they've already met the fund minimum. So anyway, that's the type of fund that I have. It is very customizable. If their money isn't deployed into something else, like all of the proceeds that come off of these deals sit in their cash balance. And if another deal comes up, they can put 100% of their cash balance, regardless of whether it meets a typical $50,000 minimum or not, into the next deal that I'm raising for. So they can reinvest their capital a lot quicker and don't have to wait to accumulate another $50,000 to pop into a different syndication.
Good stuff, man. That was really important for the aspiring fund manager to hear, kind of like what some of these new fund managers like Brian and myself have been learning along the way. There's a lot to learn. It's an entire ecosystem, a little sub niche of capital raising that we have been able to figure out, and it's got a lot of benefits. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so on fire. But with that, let's go into the lightning round, man. Let's start with this question. How much of your personal success do you attribute to mindset?
Most of it. I think if it wasn't for mindset, I wouldn't do anything. I went to college with the mindset that I can get a degree, I can finish it. I went into the Marine Corps with the mindset that it's supposed to be the hardest service, but I got this. So a lot of it's just mindset. And I know there's been a lot of very specific instances in my multifamily career where I've had big mindset shifts, but for the most part, I've always gone into things saying, yeah, I can do that. And without that mindset, I wouldn't even try half the time.
Cool. Tell me the craziest thing you've seen during your travels.
Oh, this is a little bit of a sad story. I was in Djibouti, which is northeast corner of Africa, very small country, very poor country. People would routinely go through our dumpsters looking for food. Whatever scraps that we left in MREs is what we call them, the packaged foods they give us. These people would just grab bags, stock it up, half-eaten pieces of bread, and it was heart-wrenching. It really was. And what was worse is we were given very specific orders not to engage, not to do anything positive or negative to the local populace. So wow. Keep our distance. So it was difficult to watch.
I bet. That sounds crazy. How about this? Favorite childhood memory?
I did not do a lot of traveling growing up. And so I would say I picked my two favorites. During the summer between my junior and senior year and the summer after my senior year, I was a competitive swimmer. My best friend was...
Ooh, I didn't know that.
I was okay. My best friend had at one point the state record. So he was going to events to win, and I was going to participate and be along for the ride. But summer of my junior year, you know, I got on a plane for the first time and went to a swim camp. And the summer after my senior year, got on a plane for my second time and went to Hawaii for big swim meet. I think looking back at my childhood, I think those are two biggest moments because it's like, not that I was stuck where I was at. It's just like, finally, I get to go somewhere besides Utah. And that's where I grew up.
But do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
Looking back at it, my biggest breakthroughs have come being around people who are doing what I want to do. So the hack is talk to people who are years ahead of you and you get those breakthroughs.
How has your experience in the military made you a better syndicator?
I think the U.S. government is probably the only larger bureaucracy in the world, but one thing about it is it's very systematized. It's plug and play. It doesn't matter what unit you're at. You're, for the most part, going to do everything the same. Marines all put their boots on the same way. It doesn't matter where they're at. They wear their uniform the same way. It doesn't matter where they're at. It's systems. It's a very large organization that is heavily reliant on systems. And Marines are literally plug and play into the system, and they're taught the system from day one, and everything in the Marine Corps is plug and play. And it's something that when I look at syndications and when I look at everything, it's like, we need to figure out how to do it once and then just rinse and repeat and keep on doing the same thing over and over and over again with obvious improvements along the way, but the systems.
Very cool. How about this, man? Because I didn't know that you were into paddleboarding. What do you love best about that?
I've enjoyed the water. I was a competitive swimmer. So ever since I really figured out how to keep my head above water, I've liked the water. And paddleboarding is kind of the best of both worlds. You can go a lot faster. You can see more. I mean, when you're swimming in the ocean, you don't see a lot. Sometimes you don't see above the next wave, but it's peaceful most of the time, unless you're in like really rough patch. But it's pretty peaceful. You're on top of the water. You got great scenery and you get a little exercise while doing it as well.
Cool. Two more questions. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Not that I know of. As far as near-death experiences, I think my little brother is a miracle by himself. He's born in 1985. He was 2.5, almost 3 months premature, weighed 1.5 pounds at birth and still alive. So if that's not a miracle, I don't know what is.
Love it. All right, last question brought to you by Shanna Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
I think the biggest impact that I have is going to be with just other people. encouraging other people to give. And I haven't talked about this a lot, but I'm going to be starting a group that I call Six Figure Givers, people who have a goal to give six figures to charitable sources or charitable organizations. But it's one of those things right now, I'm not at the point where I can give six figures. Well, I probably could, you know, let's be honest, I could, but where I could do it comfortably. But I want to get to the point where I'm given six figures, and I want to encourage other people to do the same thing. And I think when you talk about what impact I want, if I can encourage other people to be generous in giving, it's going to multiply anything that I can do.
Very awesome answers on the lightning round. I love that part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions and our sponsors, Good Egg Investment, Syndication Pro, Apartment Educators, The Family Office Club, and PitchDecks.com. Go to thecapitalraisershow.com to see all of our sponsors' deals. Brian, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
So easy. I got two websites, depending on what you're interested in. If you're interested in passively investing, streamlinecapitalgroup.com. If you're interested in our educational program, The Tribe of Titans, which teaches people how to syndicate, it's thetribeoftitans.info.
Okay, cool. And don't forget to check out The Diary of an Apartment Investor, one of my favorite shows, really good stuff on there. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser and or multifamily syndicator as they scale in their business?
Yeah, I would say the biggest myth or the biggest lie in the industry is when people say, if you have a good deal, the money's going to come. All right, I'm going to turn that on its head and tell you the absolute truth. If you have the money, the good deals will come. That's the honest truth right there. If you have the money, you're going to be able to have your pick of the deals and you can get the best one.
That's fantastic. That's why you need to be raising money today, not when you have the deal, guys. So that's really good stuff, man. Thanks for coming on the show. Yeah. Getting ready to wrap up here, man. Enjoy the rest of your day. I really appreciate you coming on and walking us through this particular moment as you transition into being a fund manager. Really good stuff, dude. Thank you.
Thanks, Ruben. Appreciate it.